I believe politicians are the only ones benefiting from the death penalty because they can use it as a simple formula, supposedly, that it's tough on crime.
The United States is the only industrialized country that still has a death penalty for crime. Helen Prejean authored a book on the subject, Dead Man Walking.
This is part two.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Far from the rhetoric that's in Congress over the crime bill, and far from the rhetoric of the debates that go on in the legislative assemblies, finally boils down to like Sergeant Bourgeois and Major Taylor and Lieutenant Smith, whose job it is that night to take a condemned man from a cell and bring him down the hall and put him in a chair and kill him. The death house in Louisiana is 5 miles deep in the prison. It's a house built especially for death. You have the execution chamber there, you have holding cells, and that's where people are killed. And so I tell the story of Major Felton Cootie, who's a supervisor on death row in Louisiana, and he was part of that strap down team. And after he'd been through 5 executions, he called me into his office one day, and he said, "Sister, I gotta tell you," and I knew right away, as soon as I walked in, I was looking in the eyes of a very troubled man. He said, "I come home after these executions and I sit in my easy boy chair for the rest of the night. I can't eat and I can't sleep." And he said, "Now don't get me wrong, I don't condone what these guys have done." And he knew them. He knew every man on the row. He knew their crimes. He said, "Some of the crimes they've done are heinous. But when you are close to it like this and you are part of it," and his job wasn't even to be the ones who constrained them to take them to the chair. It was after they were killed, then his job was to take a paper bag and go pick up their toothbrush and their soap and their personal belongings to give to their family. And he said, "I can't do it anymore. I'm gonna have to quit this." And he did. I heard that several months after we had this conversation, he quit because he couldn't do it anymore. One of the guards whispered to Tim Baldwin shortly before he was executed, "Tim, you got to understand, this is nothing personal." And in this whole process, everybody tries to wash their hands of personal responsibility for the death of another human being. And the American public is just really removed from it because they're never there. It's by design that executions are in secret. It's by design that only a few people come, because they want to keep it under wraps, because by and large, people who have been at executions, even when they bolstered by it's legal, we need to do this and all, come away from it shaken human beings. There's tough on these radio talk shows that have been on, people calling, "I'd fry them myself, I'll pull the switch." That's people's rage talking. But when it comes down to killing a concrete human being, it is very difficult to do that. And that's partly why I wrote the book. I wanted people to see, and partly why we need to abolish the death penalty, is because it involves good people like Felton Cootie and Sergeant Bourgeois and people like that in the killing of a fellow human being. We have a growing number of wardens and people who have been close to executions, like Don Cabana, the warden at Mississippi, supervised I don't know how many executions. Now he's not warden anymore. He is very outspoken against the death penalty. Anyway, there's a whole ritual for killing people. They move them down to cell one when they're the next one to die on the tier, so the guards can begin to take notes, keep a log on them, how they're bearing up under it. Does it look like they're going to go nuts? Should we give them medication? Does it look like they're going to escape? Does it look like they're going to try to commit suicide? And then a few days before they die, they bring them to the death house where they sit in a cell a few feet away from the chair and wait to die. And I went with Pat in that. By the time they moved him there, I went, and I was the only one who would visit him in the death house. He didn't want his mama coming in there. He knew she'd break apart. So I was it. I was terrified. On one level, it was terrifying. On another, it was very confusing. Because when you go in the death house, they have these brightly polished tiles, there's a coffee pot percolating, the guards talk to you, people are basically friendly to you and all, and I kept feeling like I was in a hospital. I couldn't believe the end result of this was that they were going to kill this man. And then the time time is like no other time in that kind of waiting. On the one hand, the watch hands are just reeling around the clock and time is flying. Another way, time is staying stock still. And the only way I could make it psychologically was I had to live in the present moment. I couldn't think of what was going to happen on midnight of April the 5th, 1984. I mean, that was the date of his execution. Then the time got close, and then the guards come in, and there's this whole ritual of preparing his body for execution. You know, they shaved his hair and his eyebrows, cut the left pants leg of his leg, shaved around the calf of his leg where the electrode was to go, put a clean white t-shirt on him. They never send people to the chair with a dirty shirt. There's a whole thing of trying to make death clean, which is what lethal injection is too. It's like, well, at least they're not suffering as much as they made the victim suffer. But to kill a human being is to kill a human being. The torture is in conscious human beings being condemned to death, who anticipate death and die 1,000 times before they die. And if we can acknowledge that brainwashing is mental torture, can we acknowledge that condemning conscious human beings to death and sometimes getting within hours of death and then getting a stay and beginning the process over again? I've been with 3 people who have been executed, and each one of them by the end said, I am so tired. And their family is going through this. The unseen victim is the family of the executed person. People consider them guilty by association. Some people change their names. They don't want people to know they have a brother on death row, whatever. And then when it comes to the execution itself, Pat Saunier was very, very remorseful for what had happened. He was the older brother, and Eddie was the volatile one. And as the story unfolded, I came to have real doubts that Pat was the one who shot and killed those kids. But of course, it was all too late. It was too late to get an attorney to try to show in the courts. But Pat never said, I'm innocent. And he wasn't innocent because he had participated in the abduction of kids. He was part of a fabric that had led to death. And he felt, I said, well, Pat, you know, then you deal with the big things when you're going to die. Like I said, Pat, do you believe that God loves you and that you're forgiven, that you're loved by God, and even though you were part of this? And he gave me his Bible. Now, the stereotypical thing of people in prison is that people get this jailhouse religion. That does happen. I've seen that happen. This man's Bible had the Psalms underlined, like Psalm 31, oh God, they plot to take my life, but you are my rock, on you I stand. And that clinging to God and clinging to the dignity that God gives you, that you are my son, you have value and dignity to your life, because you get so many signals that you're trash, that you're disposable, that you're going to be killed. And the scripture verse that I picked to read with Pat as we walked together to the chair was Isaiah 43, I have called you by your name and you are mine. If you pass through the fire, you will not be burned. And in Dead Man Walking, I take you through all of this. I know it's the only way people are really going to get close to what goes on. And I wanted to tell the story, and I tell it in an honest way. When I make mistakes, I talk about my mistakes. I don't try to make Pat Saunier into this hero because he's getting executed, because he did a very bad thing. I don't condone that. But the process of execution itself is just a terrifying thing to see. And Pat and I had talked about whether or not I'd be there. And he said, oh, no, sister. He said, look, it could really harm you, psychologically scar you to see something like this. He was trying to be brave, and he was trying to protect me, which I appreciated. But I went, Pat, there is no way you're going to die with all those witnesses there that want to see you die. And you look at me, you look at my face, and God will give me the grace. And God did. There is a strength. It was like, as long as I was in the present moment, if I stepped out of this little circle of light, and would think what was going to happen in a few hours, I would come unravel. I remember going into the women's room in the death house. They had a bathroom for women. It was the only private place in the death house. And I remember going in there and kind of just putting my head against that tile wall and holding my crucifix in my hand that's hanging around my neck, saying, God, please help me. Don't let him fall apart. I didn't know what I would do if he would fall apart. And then we counted the hours. I prayed with him. He received, you know, the last sacraments of the church. He had been through a crucible And he was filled with love there at the end. He was a transformed man. Because he kept thinking of me, are you okay? Are you all right? Thank you for loving me. It's a shame a man has to come to prison to find love. Take care of my mama. He wrote a letter to Eddie, which Eddie read every night for I don't know how many years before he'd go to sleep, basically just telling Eddie, look, Eddie, I'll be okay. You live your life, and like basically saying, I know what really happened, but it's okay. And giving him permission to live and giving him his love and whatever forgiveness was needed in it, you know. And then it comes to 10 o'clock. That's when the strap-down team comes in, and there's a guard called Slick. They call him Slick because he's got a head like a light bulb. There's no hair on it. And he came, and that's when they shaved his hair, and they prepared his body and all. And then at 11:30, they went back in the cell with him one more time, and he came out, and his eyes, like, glittered with anger and humiliation, and he said, I'm a grown man, and I have to leave this world with a diaper on. That's why they've done away with electrocution and switch to lethal injection. It's a little cleaner. But anyway, and then we walked. They brought him out. It was midnight. The warden said, okay, Sonia, time to go. And I remember thinking, God, I'm in a movie. This is a movie. And I had his Bible. And when he came out, he said, warden, can I ask you one question? Can Sister Helen touch my arm? And the warden nodded his head like this. And it's the first time I'd ever touched him. You know, they didn't allow contact visits. And I put my hand on his shoulder, and we walked. And those chains on his legs dragged across that floor. And he had said, I just pray that God holds up my legs. Because he didn't want to faint. He didn't want to have to be dragged to the chair. You marshal all of your dignity as a person that you will walk to your death. And then we came into the execution chamber. And then I just leaned over. I was real close to him. And I just kissed him on the back. And I said, Pat, pray for me. And he turned around. And his voice was husky like a little kid's. And he said, Sister Helen, I will. And then I went and sat with the witnesses. And then he looked at me. His last words were to the victims. He asked for forgiveness for what had happened. But he said very simply, but Eddie done it. And then he went and he sat in the chair, and they acted very quickly. All those guards are very task-oriented. My job is strap the left leg, the right arm. The warden stands over in the corner by two red telephones, one to the governor's office, one to the courts. If the phones ring, he lives. If they don't ring, he dies. Everyone else gets out of the execution chamber behind a plywood blind. Is an anonymous executioner being paid $400. Who will kill him? The witnesses are behind a plexiglass, and you kind of feel like you're looking at a film or something. You know what's going to happen, and then you watch it, and it's very hard to assimilate what your eyes are seeing. And he saw me before they put the mask over his face, and he attempted to smile, but it didn't. He couldn't smile. It came off as a kind of a twitch. And then they put the mask over his face, and I knew he couldn't see me anymore, but he knew I was there, and I closed my eyes and heard as they clanged the switch and killed him. And I came out of that execution chamber that night, and I've been talking to people about the death penalty ever since. And people need real information, see? They need to know that it's just the state imitating the violence and showing that they can kill as well as individuals, but they also need to know that we got an alternative to the death penalty. That people who commit first-degree murder are not getting out of prison after a few short years. State legislatures in 48 out of 50 states now have revised sentencing for first-degree murder. They're either doing real life without parole sentences, or they're doing mandatory long-term sentences like 40 years, 30 years, before they can even be considered for parole. Governors aren't commuting sentences of first-degree murders because they're political animals, and they know that's the hardest thing politically to do. There's an alternative to it. And in the book, I just load it with information that I know people aren't going to get unless I tell them about how exorbitantly costly it is to execute one person. It's like a Cadillac in the criminal justice system. Everything costs more money to have capital punishment than even to have life. It costs six times more, four times more. Texas is spending $3.2 million for each person that they execute, over against a life sentence, which is about $600,000, where a person's working to help defray their board and keep, whereas on death row, you don't work. You're just guarded. You just wait. Everything about it's more expensive. That's a factor, too.
Are public opinion polls still showing that the majority of American people support capital punishment?
Yeah, you know what's interesting? When I did research for Dead Man Walking, I found in the whole history of this country, there was only one time in the United States in the 60s, like about 62, where it fell below 50%. That when people were asked the question, do you support capital punishment for first-degree murder? It's real high now. I mean, the polls show, what, 75% or whatever. But you know what's interesting about this? It's when people are asked the question in the abstract, do you support capital punishment for people who commit first-degree murder? When they are given an alternative question and say, do you support capital punishment if you could be assured that the person would have life without parole? It drops close to 50%. And very interesting, when people are asked the question, suppose we had the life without parole sentence for first-degree murderers, but in some way their labor could go to restitution to victims' families, which do you prefer, capital punishment or that? Over 60% of people choose that. Now, some people say, well, that's not practical because there's no way that can be worked out that their labor could be, you know, going to victims' families. Of course, we could do that if we chose to do that. But the important thing, it shows the sentiment of the American public. People do want to be protected from people who have done the most violent thing. But actually, people would really prefer if there was some way that a person who would serve his life in prison, that part of his labor could go to restitution. They prefer that. But the question's almost never asked that way. But I've been educating people about the death penalty for 12 years now. I'll go to anybody ask me to talk. My smallest audience was to a nursing home in New Orleans. There were three people who came. It was after lunch, and two of them nodded off while I was talking. But one lady was listening, and I was talking. And I've been talking about the death penalty. I did a lot more talking before I wrote the book. When people get real information, and they hear how they're being manipulated on this issue by politicians, that it's got nothing to do with containing crime. Like Louisiana, for example, executed 8 people in 8.5 weeks in 87. That was after the McCluskey decision. The murder rate in New Orleans went up 16.3%. The only effect, really, those executions had were on juries, which before then were handing down death sentences about 10 a year. After the executions, it slowed to a trickle. People have no idea how the death penalty is a huge lottery system. They hear the rhetoric about the death penalty. It's only for people who commit the most heinous crimes, and those are the ones who can get the death penalty, right? When you think that there are 24,000 homicides in this country every year, 1% of people get selected for the death penalty, and it follows a pattern. Over 85% of them get selected because they kill white people. One of the key things that drives the death penalty, and the reason it's never going to be fair and across the board, is it depends on who you kill. When minorities are killed, when homeless people are killed, you know, when people of color are killed, when poor people are killed, there's not the same drive in a DA's office to get justice for that person. Their lives don't count as much. They're more dispensable. When victims, in quote, of status get killed, victims, the dominant race, ethnic group in this society, white people can identify with, and almost all DAs are white, almost all judges are white, almost all juries. One of the things DAs try to do is get black people off of juries. They try to use their strikes because black people are compassionate and they tend to vote for life more. I mean, you can look at. I mean, I visit a man on death row now, and he's a black man. A white woman was killed in this little southern town. He had an all-white jury, and the courts are upholding that, you know. So you have, the way race is the most crucial is who got killed, because to go for an ultimate punishment and all it costs to send the investigators to go through the whole thing of a capital trial, you got to have rage over the death of that victim. If you don't have rage, well, it was just so-and-so. Like, we have a murder victims group of about 40 women in the St. Thomas Project, all black women, all indigent. Some have lost two. Shirley Carr lost two sons within 6 months. Has the DA's office gone for the death penalty in any of those cases? In fact, they haven't even come to trial. So there's a discretionary and a selectivity involved in when ultimate punishments are sought and when they're not. They put the microscope on Chattahoochee County in Georgia, and did a very careful study. Let's just see, when does the DA's office go for the death penalty and when they don't? And found that when white people were killed, they went for the death penalty one out of every three times, visited the victims' families, asked them their wishes. When black people were killed, they went for the death penalty one out of 17 times. And so when people say, well, look, we just need to make this thing fair, to make it fair, we would have to change all of the soil in the United States in order for the tree to grow right. Because integral to the soil is racism in this country. And the key thing about racism, if you look at who's on death row in the United States, you can break it down. It's close to 50% people of color and 50% white. So people go, oh, well, look, that sounds pretty fair. But then you have to ask, who did they kill? And almost always when people of color are killed, like in Louisiana, it's because children were killed, security officers or law enforcement officers were killed. Only when certain people get killed who are people of color do they go for the death penalty. So it's always going to be selective. And people have no idea how much discretionary power DAs have. And one of the factors that make DAs sometimes willing to plea bargain or not is what kind of defense they're up against. They don't want to go into court and lose. So here you got a poor person. They know they're going to be able to get in there and win because they got a court-appointed attorney or they got a public defender who's defending all these people and can't put time into the case. Amnesty International just did a study on what would comprise an adequate defense, like how many hours lawyers would need to spend, and came up with about at least 500 hours and found that in most cases with public defenders or court-appointed attorneys for the poor, they do about 50 hours. Pat Sonier's attorney visited with him twice before his trial to prepare his defense. Two half-hour periods. One was on the morning of the trial itself. That's the kind of defense he had. You know, the working definition of capital punishment is capital punishment means then when out to capital, get the punishment. And money counts in everything in this country. It counts for what kind of education you get, what kind of health care you get. It especially counts what kind of legal defense you get. So poor people, over 95% of the people selected for death are poor. And Amnesty has documented, they've done a study of every country that does the death penalty and finds that no matter what the high-flown rhetoric of the death penalty is about and that we need this to be tough on crime, inevitably, countries always select minorities or the people who are least able to defend themselves who will bear the burden of the ultimate punishment for crimes.
So what is it going to take to ultimately abolish the death penalty?
The same thing that it took to abolish slavery. We're in the second abolitionist movement in this country, and it's to educate people. I think the key thing is for people to see that the death penalty, not only does it not curtail crime, that it's an imitation of violence, okay, but it's a huge diversionary tactic where you're using all of your resources to kill a few people in this very lottery-like fashion. And meanwhile, we got kids getting out of control in this society. On any given day in New Orleans, we have 10 to 20,000 truant kids in the public schools in New Orleans. A third of them, minimally, conservatively, have access to guns. What will really make us safer? Executing a few people a year in this random fashion that we do, or beginning to intervene with the young and doing the real things that prevent people from being violent. Solid education, counseling, drug prevention, job training, the development of jobs. I mean, the percentage of people on death row who didn't have a job at the time of the crime is huge. The percentage of people on death row who were abused as children is huge. Those are the things we need to address if we really are going to make ourselves safer. Remember there was a big story about this tourist from Europe that was killed in Florida by these kids? Well, those kids that killed that person, they had been in the juvenile system, but they'd gone through the turnstile and been spit out of it. They weren't really helped when they first got to those kids. That's where we need to put our energies and our resources.
Where does the Supreme Court stand now? Didn't they rule that the death penalty is not in violation of the Constitution?
God, I've read all these Supreme Court decisions, you know. Interesting. In Furman, in 1972, the Supreme Court said that the death penalty was unconstitutional, not in and of itself per se, that it defied the Eighth Amendment, which says that we will not practice torture or cruelty against people, okay? That's what they should have done. They should have just acknowledged that. But they said it was unconstitutional because it was arbitrarily and capriciously applied. It was like being hit with lightning. Who got the death penalty? Who didn't? In whose county was it done? Was it, you know, who? All those arbitrary factors. They reinstituted the death penalty in Gregg, in the decision of Gregg in 1977. Supposedly, they did guided discretion, so it wouldn't be arbitrary and capricious anymore. It is just as arbitrary and capricious as it ever was. The Supreme Court uses words like dignity, that it's not incommensurate with the dignity of a person to kill them. They are denying that it is the practice of torture. The Supreme Court is wrong. The law is wrong. It needs to be changed. But when you look at race, when you look at the history of the U.S. Supreme Court on race, and the racial decisions, like in Dred Scott, they upheld basically the whole slavery thing. And then in Plessy v. Ferguson, they upheld racism and the Jim Crow laws in the South. And then in McCloskey, which could clearly show that the selection of death overwhelmingly is people who kill white people, that race is a determining factor. In McCloskey, the Supreme Court even acknowledged that there was racial factors in it, but it would be too disruptive of the criminal justice system to prescribe a remedy for it. So they do racist things. You know, I believe that we should be law-abiding people. Laws are what hold us together as a community. Law is the way we respect each other and care for each other. But when laws are wrong, they need to be changed. I mean, there was a time in this country when over 70% of people just simply accepted that some people could be slaves, and it was written that way into the Constitution. But then we amend the Constitution when we need to make a change.
So you're still working in New Orleans, but you're also the chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty that's based in Washington, D.C.
And would hope that people, you know, listening to this that are against the death penalty, what we need to do is we need to galvanize those people. One in every five Americans already is against the death penalty, even if you consider 80% of our, let's go with the 20%, okay? We need those people. We need them to come forward and to join. And states have coalitions, you know, New Mexico Coalition Against the Death Penalty that sponsored my visit here. Get their number and become an abolitionist.
So Tim Robbins is making a movie based on your book.
One of the sisters, it's funny, in my religious community, you know, of course the community gets all the money from anything, from the book or the movie or whatever. We share everything in common, you know. But one of the sisters said, Helen, why did they choose Susan Sarandon to be you? I don't think she looks like you at all. And Susan's question was, am I going to have to cut my hair for this movie? I said, look, nuns don't all cut their hair. There's no regulations like the military that your hair has to be a certain length or whatever. And I didn't know these movie stars from a hole in the ground, you understand. When I met Susan for supper, I had to go rent Thelma and Louise to just see what the lady looked like, okay? And the funny thing was, during the movie, I thought she was Thelma. And I did see when she came in the restaurant, I went, oh, my God, she's Louise.
Sister Helen Prejean gave this interview in 1995 to Carol Boss at Community Radio KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. As of January 2021, the death penalty is still legal in the U.S. and 26 states. Two states have moratoriums on executions. After Trump-appointed judges reversed a 17-year federal moratorium, he executed 13 prisoners in 7 months. Sister Helen Prejean is still campaigning. A recent documentary can be streamed at sisterhelen.org. Thank you, Wings supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent free events can be streamed from maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement.org. To contact Wings, email wings@wings.org. Our sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.